You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. I get to say that again.
It is bright and beautiful and sunny and really confusing here in Northern California. Today, March 18th, as Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast on Thursday, March 19th, 2026, the high temperature today is going to be 88 degrees. That's about 20 degrees above average for this time of year. Tonight's low temperature is going to be 57. Thursday is going to be 90 degrees and sunny, needless to say. Thursday night will be 57 and clear. Friday will be 90 and sunny. And Friday night will be 59 and mostly clear. And Saturday will be partly sunny and 88. Some clouds coming in on Saturday. Saturday night, 56. These are temperatures that we associate with the first or second week of May, not with the second or third week of March. Sunday, high is going to be 83, mostly sunny. Sunday night, partly cloudy, 53, and then we cool down fairly rapidly, and this is what we've been interested in. Monday, partly sunny with a high near 79, and Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 52, and Tuesday, partly sunny with a high near 78. I've been watching with some interest as the site called Ventusky, ventusky.com, which is a really cool graphic interface where you can go in and you can set the temperature at 5 a.m. for a particular day, 7, 8, 10 days down the road. And they keep showing up when I do this with temperatures on the 24th of, let's say, 38 or 39 degrees. So wait, I don't know how...
38?
Yeah, I don't know quite how seriously to take this. This is only one of the models is showing this, but it is going to be a significant cool down. I'll be very surprised if we get below 40. But what we are looking at is temperatures back in the low to mid 40s, sometime mid to late part of next week, and then back in what you might call normal temperature range for this area. We've now been through about a week of unusually warm temperatures all over California.
So when we have something like this, this is 20 degrees weird.
But yes, that's a good term like for it. Yes.
Do we plan and plant and do our things according to what it should be, or we go, oh, it's May, and we do the May things. We do the stuff we're supposed to do in March, right?
It depends on your risk tolerance. Okay, so needless to say, with temperatures in the 80s and nights in the 50s, every garden center has just gone, okay, fine. Hardware stores are doing the same thing, bringing in all the summer stuff that's available. Some of that I have doubts about. Others I think are probably fine. The question I have is, you as a gardener, are you going to put these in now and go, if we get cold again, are you going to be fine with the fact that they may be set back? The young vegetables is mainly what we're talking about, young flowers, things like that. It's a great time to plant shrubs, perennials, trees, all that kind of thing.
Those won't care.
They don't care. No, that's right. Yeah. These are not things that care. The only thing we're running into there is people wanting the real heat lovers, you know, hibiscus, lantana, verbena, things like that, which just aren't really ready yet from a lot of growers in Northern California because they need to catch
up. March.
Yeah, it's March. That's what we feel like saying. It's March. As to the others, well, you know, I have one customer. Two, actually, because it's always fun to talk to them about this every year. If they don't have their tomatoes in the ground by March 15th, they start getting agitated. They start getting stressed. They start thinking, I'm too late. And they've been doing this every year. And one of them is a gentleman in his 80s, and the other is in his 60s or 70s. So they've been doing it for a long time, and it works for them. Now, one of them came in on the 15th, and bought a bunch of tomatoes. And I'm happy to say next day he posted a picture of them in his garden in the ground, each with a little tomato cage next to it. And he said, there, tomatoes planted. Great. And you know, he's been doing this for a long time. He gets results that are adequate to him. His risk tolerance is relatively high. So my answer to that is do it if you want. There's not going to be a shortage. We're not all going to run out of these things, but you know, they're there and the temperatures are unusually warm. Our concern, as always, is we could rapidly go back into colder night temperatures, colder soil temperatures that could affect some of them. But we've given you the planting guidelines. And at this point, the plants are out there. The only thing we are encountering, it's early in the season to have a big inventory. There's a lot of seedling, you know, crops that are still coming on. We're just planting some of these things in our greenhouses. So, you know, not the exact variety you have may not be there now, but I understand many serious gardeners are in the acquisition phase. They're out there finding the variety they want or the 10 varieties they're going to plant, and they're going to go ahead and get them now. So we could cool off rapidly. More likely, we'll trend downward to what we might consider somewhat more normal temperatures for next week. And until then, it's absolutely gorgeous outside. People are out enjoying the weather. A little concerned, perhaps, about how early this heat is coming on. I do want to mention way longer term climate issue is that we've got some real conversation going right now about a pretty strong El Nino developing for 2026, 2027. Normally, spring is early for climate scientists to be making these projections, but all of the models are converging on a very strong El Nino for this coming winter. So this is something when it's, you know, when it's way out of the typical range, it is something they feel they can predict a little bit earlier. And this past week, according to a reputable climate blog, a number of modeling groups that forecast future ENSO conditions have released forecasts suggesting a very strong El Nino may be in the works for late 2026. And this is a notable revision upwards from earlier forecasts in January and February, which had suggested that El Nino might develop, but it would likely be more modest. Historically, they talk about the spring predictability barrier. This time of year is challenging to predict. But looking at 11 different models with 433 total ENSO forecasts, they all show a high likelihood of a very strong El Nino event. What that means for us typically here in Northern California, strong El Nino in our region correlates with high rainfall. So there's a pretty high likelihood from the looks of this that we will be going into a wet year. This one is going to be comparable from everything they're seeing now to El Nino event we had in 2015, 2016. So that was memorable, to put it mildly. That particular El Nino event in 2015 was one of the strongest that they'd ever seen. And the prediction was a really wet winter. And then it didn't happen that winter. It was a normal-ish winter. And we'd just come off of 5 years of drought. 2016, we had 11 inches of rain in January 2017. Okay, so we the El Nino had a lag effect, but we had a lot of rainfall December, January, and into February that year. So just mentioning it now, because when they're predicting it with this much confidence this early, that suggests something pretty strong is brewing out there. KDRT is community radio. That means we're public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. And so if you like what you hear, if you like all the programming here at KDRT, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. You will find at kdrt.org all kinds of programs. Just click on the schedule guide to see. And there's a whole bunch of music shows. I do one, and there's probably 25 other locally produced music shows. There are some public affairs shows, and one that has been on air now for a couple of years is Mapping Healthcare, a radio show and podcast where a medic, Dr. Ulfat Shaikh, with a map, explores ways in which people around the globe make the world of healthcare better and what we can learn from them. She is a physician, medical educator, researcher who leads programs to help people access high-quality healthcare and stay healthy. And all the past episodes of public affairs shows are archived forever. You can find Mapping Healthcare on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Check it out, kdrt.org, Mapping Healthcare. That broadcasts live Fridays, 5:30 to 6 p.m. Replay Saturday, 8 to 8:30 in the morning, just right before the Davis Garden Show rebroadcast on Saturday mornings. Yeah, check that out. I want to mention, for those of you that have sent us notes about delays in the Davis Garden Show podcast, we are aware of them. We do appreciate it when you let us know. There have been ongoing website problems at the KDIRT website, which have caused Well, basically, we've got one stalwart volunteer who's hand uploading the shows one by one and getting them in there. And he goes in the morning and uploads as many as he can upload at that time. So there's been about a 24 to 48 hour delay on getting them up there, and that affects the podcast. But we really do appreciate your letting us know, because in some cases, that is what has brought to our attention the website problem. So don't hesitate. If there's a gap or some problem, send a note to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. Arboretum event, we do have sales coming up, but more to the point, you can weed out stress. You personally can help the Arboretum and Public Garden by joining them to weed out stress. Spring is the busiest season for weeds in the Arboretum and Public Garden and your own backyard. And we can use extra hands to get a handle on them. They do this every couple of weeks. Actually, they're doing a lot of them. We've got one on April 4th, 9 a.m. We've got one on April 9th, 9 a.m. So you can head on over there and just help pull weeds. You know, that doesn't take a lot of special training. It's very relaxing, I can tell you from experience, and you could be helping out the UC Davis Arboretum. For information on these kinds of events, you just go to arboretum.ucdavis.edu and click on the events link.
All right. Kathy and John, who are listeners of ours, sent in this question. Hi, Don. Have you tried some of these new heat-resistant varieties in this Master Gardener article? And then they had a link to a ucanr.edu blog called the Savvy Sage.
Yeah, Savvy Sage.
And this article is 11 new varieties of tomato seedlings.
And I have not tried most of these, actually. Savvy Sage is the blog of the Yolo County Master Gardeners. It's a great one, and you can find it at the ucanr.edu site. In fact, this is simple. ucanr.edu/blog/savvy-sage. That's pretty easy to find.
S-A-V-V-Y.
Dash Sage. And they've got March garden tips, vegetable planting, things like that. And there are 11 new varieties here. Tanya Kushak is spearheading this particular project of growing some of these seedlings for their sales. The sales are April 4th and 11th. And the plant list is quite interesting, but there are a number of varieties they're growing that are from this new open source, is what I'm calling it, open source breeding program, where a bunch of plant breeders have been cooperating with each other, trading plant materials, unlike the usual pattern in our industry where F1 hybrids are jealously guarded and maintained as proprietary lines. These folks are sharing information, sharing genetic resources, you might say, and they've been working to develop true dwarf tomatoes. And there are several that have come on the market, which I have not had a chance to try yet. I'll be growing a number of these this year. So they'll have some of these. One of our listeners, Charlie, sent some seed to my friend, Fred Hoffman. Fred's starting some of them. So we'll be growing those out here on the West Coast. New Big Dwarf was the parent, grandparent, great-grandparent of a bunch of these from a 1915 seed catalog, okay? And one of the breeders took that and did some first crosses and created some dwarf and heirloom varieties in 2005, and now about 100 varieties have been released by the Dwarf Tomato Project, DTP. You can just Google Dwarf Tomato Project, an all-volunteer project with participants from tomato forums worldwide growing out and selecting varieties. A bunch of them on there, Tasmanian Chocolate, Dwarf Golden Tipsy, and so forth. And they'll be selling some of these at this sale for the Yolo County Master Gardener fundraiser.
Which is at Woodland Community College.
Thank you.
2300 East Gibson Road. Go up Poline Road to East Gibson and you'll be right there.
Can't miss it. And that's April 4th and April 11th, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. They're going to have a bunch of other varieties. And I do like this one paragraph here. Friends and neighbors have been touting Nova F1. Don't know that one. Principa Borghese. Oh, yeah. And Celebrity for several years. Try them and see what you think. So I will try Nova. I grow Principa Borghese every year because it's an Italian heirloom, as they say here, famous for sun drying in the summer. This is one of those things where that is true that it's famous for sun drying, but it's a great tomato. That's not the only thing you can do with it. It's basically a very firm, meaty, cherry size, elongated, Roma-shaped tomato. It's like a miniature sauce tomato. And yes, it sun dries great. I grow a crop every year for one of my staff to take home, cut them in half, and sun dry them, which is really easy to do here in the Sacramento Valley. But I take Principa Borghese and I throw a whole bunch of them into a crock pot and cook it down to a really rich, thick sauce base. So Principa Borghese is more than just a sun-drying tomato. And they also mentioned Celebrity. Well, I mean, Celebrity's been on the market for 30 plus years. I would look for the new Celebrity Plus. And there's a reason for this. Celebrity came out of a breeding program for sauce tomatoes years ago, and it was not suited for that at all, but it's a very heavy yielding home garden variety. It's a nice round red tomato, good flavor, high productivity. But my experience with it has been that it had fairly open foliage canopy. It was a thin canopy. And so the fruit would sunburn really badly. I mean, I would have years where Celebrity was producing 50 fruit, but half of them were scorched on the west side of the plant. They would always sunburn. So that was very, to me, it was an undesirable characteristic to have a variety that you'd have to shade. You know, that doesn't seem like something you'd really want with a tomato. Celebrity Plus is a new version of Celebrity. It's been bred with greater disease resistance. It's got a more compact growth habit. And so, well, they mentioned it can be prone to sun scald. Celebrity Plus is less so than the original Celebrity. So Celebrity became popular for reliable productivity, really good flavor, you know, great yield. But I think you should look for the Celebrity Plus, if you possibly can, for the just denser foliage canopy that helps to shade the fruit a little bit. Well, we'll go through this list a little bit more as time goes by, but this dwarf tomato project is fascinating. I want more of you to grow these, and I would love your feedback as time goes by on the different varieties from the dwarf tomato project, how well they do in different areas, particularly the Sacramento Valley, obviously, but elsewhere in the country as well. Give them a try, see how they do, see which ones you really like. They've been bred for compact growth habit, so this would answer the one question we get a lot. Can I grow this tomato in a pot? And the answer usually is, or no, honestly. But these look like they have potential for that. When the first couple came on the market, I did stick them in a barrel with some other things. I did a barrel with a dwarf tomato and a small basil, the spicy globe basil. Something else was in there, probably a marigold. It did fine. You know, it only produced about 20 fruit, but it was fine in a container. Generally speaking, no, tomatoes are too big. The roots are too big to grow in a container. You'll have to water them constantly. But these appear to be an option for those of you limited for space and who can only grow in containers.
Well, we have messages that we get from listeners all the time, and we really appreciate those. Some are problems, some are whatever. This one from Danny, I really like this. Thank you, Danny, for sending it in. I enjoyed your discussion about lavender a couple weeks ago, but noticed that you didn't discuss culinary versus non-culinary varieties. My parents own a lavender farm. Cool. Now, this is good information. And this is one of the most frequent questions that they get. You said that the lavender plants, Provence and Grosso, were similar, and they may be similar type of plants in the garden. Yeah. But if you want to make lavender tea or put buds into baked goods, you want Provence, not Grosso. Oh, the oil from Grosso is too strong and will make your food taste like soap. Okay. My parents' farm is in Apple Hill. That's just up the way a little bit up by Placerville. Yeah. It's called Blue Stone Meadows. And she gave us the website, bluestonemeadow.com.
Yep.
Your listeners might be interested in the Lavender Blue Festival, which is held every year during the last two weekends of June, with activities at several different farms up there. Bluestone Meadow has vendors, crafts, and kids' activities on the weekend, in addition to lavender products and plants for sale. My parents also open the farm on weekdays between festival days. It's quieter on those days and would be a good time to visit and actually talk to my parents about the farm.
Yeah.
And or plants. I love your show.
Thank you very much. That's bluestonemeadow.com. And there's some really cool pictures here of not just lavenders and wreaths and what appear to be lovely paths wandering through the lavender gardens, but I see some of what look like alpacas as well. Thank you very much. There are a lot of different kinds of lavender, and they do differ considerably, actually, in their aroma. As a gardener, from my standpoint, it's just what's the growth habit? How easy is this one? Is this more resistant to crown rot, things like that? Is the bloom abundant enough to be pretty? I mean, some of them, the blooms are wonderfully fragrant, but they're sort of a dusky purple color and they don't really pop. A lot of the newer varieties are brighter colored, but a little more resinous smelling. So there are pretty distinctive differences in aroma. And it's good to know that there's people who use them for culinary purposes who actually know which is the better variety for that purpose. Provence and Grosso are two that are just really, really common in the trade. They're both pretty big. I was out after the show and I went out to go and look at my now 10, 12-year-old plants of each of those. They're sprawling 4 feet. And they're at 10 to 12 years, they've outlasted a lot of lavender plants. The typical pattern is 3 to 4 years. Then people either start cutting them back pretty hard or take them out and pop in a new one. I put these in an area where I didn't really mind if they started looking, shall we say, informal, which they did. And the Grosso is 4 to 5 feet across, the Provence 3 to 4 feet across. Nothing grows through these. They're like my sage and my rosemary plants. Once you get a solid cover of them shading the ground, you don't have a problem with weeds in that area. So that's been one of the reasons I use them in this particular part of the property. But they're bigger than a lot of people might have room for in a normal, smaller garden. So I do like to mention Hidecote, very tight grower with really silver foliage, and Munstead, both of which stay, you know, let's say 2 to 3 feet, Hidecote even shorter than that, Twinkle Purple, some of the others. There are more dwarf lavenders out there that might be handy for a lot of home gardeners. If they're in bloom, smell the flower and see if you like it. Some of them are more resinous and more pungent. Others are sweeter. So they do differ, and I appreciate the feedback.
We got a message here. Oh, let me get the name. Hi, Don and Lois. We moved into a house and have inherited an ornamental cherry plum, picture included.
Yeah.
When we moved in during winter, we noticed it had been pruned harshly.
Yes.
And many thick branches were chopped off abruptly. Now that it has flowered and leafed out this spring, I can see that several of the thick, harshly pruned branches appear to be dead with no signs of life. It leaves just half of the tree alive. Can I make this look better? Would sawing off those dead branches closer to the trunk risk opening up the tree to infection? Thanks. And this is from Emily.
Yeah, I'm not sure where this is, but someone headed this tree back, which is really a terrible thing to do. I've watched this happen where even professional tree services seemingly, or they're going by that name, will do this kind of heading cut. And very commonly, the result is dieback of the branches. Whether a disease gets in or there simply aren't growth buds there to sprout and grow, you end up with whole dead branches, which is clearly not a good thing to have on a tree of any size. So yes, the simple thing to do right now, this picture essentially shows about a third of the tree roughly has just died back. The whole branch has died all the way back to the trunk. So you should cut those off. There's no point in leaving dead branches. Cutting them off clean will be good, fine to do. I'd go ahead and cut it clean, leave a little bit of the branch collar. You can look up what I mean by that. Cut those off and hope that they'll heal over properly. No, you don't seal them. You don't cover them or anything. You just cut it off clean. Then you'll have a tree that's slightly unbalanced. The good news is, if you've got reasonable direction of light source from all around, as this tree appears to have, it's not all getting all its light from one side, it's not in the shade of another tree, pretty good chance that having removed those somewhere further down from the top of this tree, branches, buds will start to break and grow. They'll grow out into the now open area. The tree will probably, not necessarily, but probably balance itself out. Hopefully no further dieback will occur. And I would just let this tree grow out now for a year. Send us a picture next winter, because I can see looking at it that someone did this same kind of pruning cut a couple of years ago. So what you have is a tree that's been headed a couple of times, and heading is never good. Heading of smaller flowering or decorative tree at least doesn't typically create a safety issue that we're concerned about, but it is best if you can train this out of this kind of pruning over a 2 to 3 year period. So go ahead and do the pruning that we're talking about. Take off the dead branches. Give this tree some deep soakings as we go through the course of this summer. The reason I mention that is that I'm seeing oleander and echium and other low water plants in this area, and plums in general are not super low water plants. So it would be a good idea, if you want to retain this tree, to go ahead and make a bit of a basin around it, give it its own deep watering every, let's say, 2 to 4 weeks as we go through the growing season, and see if it recovers from the rough appearance is mainly our concern right now. If you decide to replace it, and I note that all the plants around it are low water, you could consider smokebush, cotinus, you could consider desert willow. There's a lot of really cool low water trees that you could consider as a replacement for that. Personally, I'm always inclined to leave a tree, give it a chance, and see if it can come back even from this kind of unfortunate pruning abuse. But my guess is that 5 years from now, you may decide if it hasn't done that, that it's time to replace it. Lots of great choices for lower water trees that would be more compatible with the things around it.
And Don said heading cuts.
Yeah.
And for those of you listening who may not know the term, it's the same as pollarding.
Sure. Yeah. Although that's done intentionally with certain species. These look like.
Well, I think this was done to pollard, but it failed.
Yes, that's true. Yes, it did not work correctly. Pollarding is funny. It's a traditional method of pruning certain trees. It's commonly done with fruitless mulberry, London plane tree. I remember at Longwood Gardens in Pennsylvania, there's a long avenue where they had done it with Paulownia, the Empress tree, which seemed like an odd choice, but it did make a very dramatic look. When you head a tree back, basically this is going up and stubbing is the term I use, cutting a tree back hard to the same point year after year. Main thing it does is control the size of the tree. If you've got a fruitless mulberry, which I can tell you from experience wants to get to be a 40 by 40 foot tree, and you like the dense shade that it provides, but you don't want a tree of that magnitude, then you just go in and you start heading it back. The problem is once you go down that road, you have to do that every year because every branch that comes out from that kind of a pruning cut is poorly attached. Either you carefully train it so that you've selected one or two of them to eventually become, important dominant scaffold limbs, or more likely for safety reasons, you're just going to keep heading it back year after year. You end up with these funny looking, scarred over stubs at the end of each branch. There's nothing wrong with it as long as you know you're basically destroying the structure of the tree. Okay. And it'd be very hard to recover the natural structure of the tree. So we never recommend heading cuts, almost ever. I can hardly think of any case where it's a desirable thing to do, but it's often done for size control. More commonly, it's done by pruning services that are not properly trained. And I think that's what's happened here.
Okay. Don sometimes send me pictures, and today he sent one, which I don't believe. I don't think this is a real thing. It says grevillea, and
Yeah.
what he sent me looks like a giant caterpillar with bright red 2-inch long spikes coming out of it. I mean, there's no flowers on this thing. I can't even see any leaves.
That's correct. This is all flower. That's an inflorescence of grevillea. I don't have a common name for grevilleas in general, but as a group, they're incredibly useful shrubs from Australia. Monterey Bay Nursery, which has a website that is great on the topic of grevilleas, says it's the third largest genus of Australian native plants after acacia and eucalyptus. I would throw in an editorial comment, and it doesn't have the drawbacks of acacias and eucalyptus. They're native all over Australia. There's hundreds of species, and 340 species, according to this comment from 2015. And it wouldn't surprise me if you add in all the cultivars and hybrids that have been introduced, you may be getting up to several hundred. Grevilleas have bottle brush-like flowers. So if you know the bottle brush plant, the callistemons, it's an inflorescence is what you're looking at. It's a whole bunch of weird flowers all grouped together.
But there's no pollen. There's no
There
yellow stuff.
is, and more to the point, way down at the base of that long tubular individual flower is a nectar reward. And I can tell you that the birds that like grevilleas more than almost anything are hummingbirds, which is interesting because there's no hummingbirds native to Australia. But apparently, they have a nectar feeding bird in Australia that is very fond of these kinds of flowers. And what we get is these bristly brushes of bright blooms. Was pretty good there. Bristly brushes of bright blooms, not just in the winter, which is cool enough. These are shrubs that typically bloom here in November, December, January, February, March. Scattered bloom anytime. Many of them bloom year around. So if you have hummingbirds resident in your area or living on your property or visiting for other reasons, this is a great way to keep them around. Also, many of the grevilleas are notably prickly. They're kind of stiff. And although they aren't all prickly, some of them are particularly prickly. And we all know that some birds really like that. They'd like to go in there and hide in there. In fact, also many mammals happen to like that. The first place that foxes nested on my property with a more permanent nest was in this large hedge of Grevillea pink pearl that I planted 25 plus years ago. It was prickly, dense, overgrown, and there was water nearby. So we had everything a fox could want, a place to hide, water nearby, and turkeys not far away leaving eggs for breakfast. So the foxes particularly like the grevilleas. And that particular one, 25 years ago, that hedge is still growing and blooming very nicely. So there's a lot of grevilleas. If you're listening anywhere in California, this can be a very important group of plants and very, very useful group of plants. But there's two things you need to look at when you're looking at any variety. One, how big does it get? because my experience and my general impression from what I've read about them is grevilleas don't take real well to pruning. You can clip them and pinch them for size control, but hard pruning with grevilleas seems to be kind of like hard pruning with ceanothus. It just shortens the lifespan. So choose one that's going to stay the right size. That's the first thing. Some of them are ground covers. A bunch of them are small shrubs. A bunch of them are big shrubs. The hedge I'm talking about, each plant is about 8 by 8. So that might be bigger than a lot of people would want in a small yard. One of them is a tree. Southern Californians know Grevillea robusta, the silk oak, which gets 50 to 60 feet and does that in a matter of 15 or 20 years. It's a fast growing tree, spectacular orange blooms, very attractive to hummingbirds, and falls apart after about 10 or 20 years. So it's not a great tree for most residential settings, but many people in Southern California will recognize it once they hear the description. Is that great big tree with the orange flowers? Yeah, that's a type of grevillea. Most people wouldn't be planting that one. So check the size and growth habit and put in one that you won't have to prune. The other thing is to check the cold hardiness, because, well, I have my trusty Sunset Western Garden book here, and I can look up grevilleas and I can see the temperature tolerance of many varieties. The last edition of the Sunset Western Garden book was published in 2012, and more hybrids and more varieties have come on the market since then. There's a couple of critical temperature thresholds. There's some that are truly subtropical. If they go below 30, 31 degrees, they'll be badly damaged in this area. So we don't plant those here in the Sacramento Valley. You can grow them in Southern California, and some of them have the most spectacular blooms. I mean, these are bloom clusters that are 6-7 inches long. If you whack it against your hand will be coated with nectar there, that full of sweet nectar rewards for butterflies and hummingbirds and others. And they're spectacular. And we all look at them when we see them on the truck going to some other nursery, and they go, "Dad, why didn't you order this one?" I said, "Read the label, hardy to 30 degrees. In my opinion, it's not safe to sell that here in Northern California." A bunch of them go down to about 25 to 28 degrees. Okay, you guys will do okay with those. When I plant them on my farm, they die because we get below 25 degrees every couple of years. So it depends on where you are. And then there's a whole lot that are hardy below 25 degrees. So if you don't even want to have to worry about the hardiness, look for those. And as I said, I mentioned Monterey Bay Nursery website. I'm looking at it right now. It's pages and pages of information about grevillea varieties and hybrids, all kinds of cold information. That's really the key thing I want you to look at, is the cold tolerance and the size of the plant before you choose one, because they sell themselves. I put a grevillea out in bloom, someone's going to buy it, and I really hope they've read the label about how big it's going to get or what its growth habit is going to be. It's a group that has a plant for every situation, practically. I wouldn't say shade. That's one thing. They're not super shade tolerant. They're okay, but sun is better. But there's ground cover forms. There's intermediate shrub forms. There's hedge size ones. And there's some that get very, very big and can provide not just privacy, but security. Those prickly needles are things you're not going to want to push your way through if you've got a hedge of grevilleas. So it's a big group. And I sent Lois a picture now because these have been blooming since November, December. That's the blooms on grevilleas are really heavy in the winter time, late winter especially. So some of my plants are in full bloom right now. But there's really not a time of year that I won't see some blooms on them. And with that density, the prickly leaves and the constant bloom, they're really attractive to hummingbirds. Grevillea. Grevilleas. Western Garden Book is a great starting point. And then Monterey Bay Nursery website, MontereyBayNSY.com. Really a remarkable resource for a lot of these Australian plants.
But now I've got some real basic question.
Okay.
I go and I buy a packet of seeds. Let's say it's one of those ones that you like doing succession planting to. And I open the packet. Now the packet's open. Is it going to rot if I don't use all those seeds right away? Can I save some of them for later? Can
we all save seeds.
Plant a few seeds here and there and a couple more weeks. And how long will those seeds in that packet last? I've opened the packet.
It varies quite a bit, and they won't tell you on the packet. My experience has been most seeds, if you store them in a dry, reasonably cool temperature area, will last for a few years. Germination percentage, so every 100 seeds you plant, the percentage that will germinate will begin to decline. You'll get more seeds that don't sprout, but you'll still get some. And I don't know how many tomato plants you need, but if you planted 15 seeds and three of them grew, that might be enough for the average household.
Why in the world would you plant 100 seeds?
People do. This is, I mean, if you are on Facebook or Nextdoor or any of those sites, we're about to begin the 8-week period in which people are selling vegetables starts online, because they started a whole package of tomato seeds. They started a whole package of pepper seeds or whatever. Yeah, that's a lot
all
more.
All at once.
All at once, right. And that's a lot more than most people need. So that would be the first thing. This is why I sometimes wonder why people are doing things from seeds when you only need one cherry tomato, folks. You don't need 6 of them or 10 of them or 20 of them. So if you're doing that many, you're presumably planning to share your seedlings. That's great, by the way. I have no problem with that kind of thing. I do want to put this out there for those of you that do this. Please use naturally sterile media. Don't use dirt from your garden. Don't use compost that you've made. Make a seedling mix that is basically things that are naturally more or less sterile. So a mix of, say, peat moss and perlite, peat moss and sand, coir and perlite, something like that. Don't use garden stuff to start seedlings and then give them to your neighbors. That, regrettably, is how diseases and pests are spread. Other than that, I think it's a great idea to share your seedlings, and this is the time to get them going. But to answer your question, tomatoes, as an example, I consider the seed to be viable for 2 to 3 years. Corn, 2 to 3 years. Some things last many, many years. Beans, I have found, are surprisingly long-lived as seeds. More to the point, you can test them. Really easy to proof the seed. So take your seeds and take a jelly roll pan. You all have one of those, right?
Of course. Why not?
Yeah. And then you take some paper towel. A jelly roll pan? Sure. A casserole dish. Take paper towels, damp paper towels, put them on the jelly roll pan. Put the seeds on there. Get some more damp paper towels. Put them on top of the seeds. Put the jelly roll pan on top of your refrigerator and check daily. And make sure to spritz it a little bit if conditions are dry to keep it moist. And the seeds will start to germinate typically in 3 to 5 days. And you'll have an idea whether you're going to get 80%, 50%, 20% germination. And by the way, those seeds that are beginning to germinate, you can then very carefully take and put out into a pot. The little root radical is fragile, so handle this very carefully. This is a grown-up thing, but tweezers will be very helpful in some cases, or if you're really good eye-hand coordination. And you can just take them and put them in a pot and grow them on from there. But it's pretty easy to proof seed, in other words, test seed for germination viability. So testing the germination of older seed is not a bad practice. You know, just get a jelly roll pan. You don't know what a jelly roll pan is?
I know what it is. I have not made a jelly roll.
Oh, I've never made a jelly roll.
In my life.
The advantage and the reason for it. I mean, you can do a plate. You can do it on whatever you want. If it's really dry, you can take saran wrap and put it over the top of the jelly roll pan to make a little mini greenhouse. So that would be the only real reason for using a casserole dish instead of a plate. But the idea is to proof the seed before you go to the trouble of putting it in that fancy soil that you bought.
A woman came in with a long list of plants that she had found on the internet for a particular situation in her yard. Mix of sun and shade, lots of criteria about height, wanted lots of bloom, had a specific color scheme, wanted us to go over the whole list one by one to determine if they were available, when they would be available if they were not now, and whether or not they were poisonous. You know, Don, it sounds like she should be contacting a landscape designer. This isn't a nursery question.
It's a nursery question you can skip the on the internet part for. This is the point I want to make on this. We don't have any problem going over these lists of plants, but in this particular case, a significant percentage of them were East Coast plants. I mean, if Google is not a regionally appropriate gardening information source, Google is pretty useless, honestly, these days. I hate to say that, but it's gotten to the point where if you Google anything with respect to horticulture, you're going to get a whole lot of sponsored ads. The first things that will pop up are a whole lot of fake sites. And it's, you know, very hard for someone who's not a trained professional to winnow through all that information. You know what we do at nurseries all the time? Help people choose plants for particular situations. That's what every garden center does. That's what the staff is trained to do. And hopefully the plants will be regionally appropriate if they're at a local garden center, or even, you know, the local branch of a hardware store, or in some cases, even the do-it-yourself chains like Lowe's and Home Depot. You know, they're a little more variable with respect to whether it's regionally appropriate, but even still, they're not going to typically have a whole bunch of stuff that would be from Connecticut or Georgia or places like that on the list. And that would save everybody a lot of time. You wouldn't have spent so much time looking up plants that are just plain not appropriate. The one thing we keep encountering is that what people are coming up with when they do Google searches are the sponsored, trademarked, patented plant programs. Proven Winners, Proven Selection. These are companies that pay a lot of money to be ranked in Google search results. And so they may or may not be appropriate to our region. They're only there in your list because they paid to be there in your list. The best place to start, certainly a designer would be a good possibility, but the best place to start would be your local arboretum, your local garden center, your local master gardeners will have information about it because gardening is local and the internet is not. And so I'm not trying to disparage all these online sites. It's just they can't sort, even if you go in there and tell it to sort what are appropriate plants for this region, you're going to get a lot of things that are not. And so it was a lot of time spent going through a lot of plants where we would just say, doesn't grow here. And the question was, well, why not? Okay, we can talk about that one by one, but why don't we focus instead of the ones that do grow here? let's look at a more positive approach to this. She had a bed which had some shade and a lot of sun. It was a pretty narrow bed. There was a wall, and you know, so it was getting hot sun part of the day for part of the bed. That's the exact kind of thing that garden centers do all the time. When I would speak to the horticulture club on campus, I would say, we answer two basic questions at our garden center all the time. What is this pest? Or I have a place that needs a plant. Those are the main things we do. We diagnose pest problems and help people, you know, understand them, accept them, or come up with a solution for them. Far more commonly, it's, I have a place that needs a plant. Do you have a suggestion? And if you're in a nursery, presumably the plants at that nursery or, you know, the local hardware store are appropriate to your region. It would save everybody a lot of trouble. Is it poisonous question is a tough one. That is really, really challenging. And I've had some very frustrating conversations with people with that one, because this is a good example. She was looking for all these plants, and then for each one, she wanted to know, is it toxic? And we said, well, what's your concern? Kids? No, it's just cats. I said, cats? These will be outdoors. Yeah, well, I mean, my neighbors have cats. So we want your landscape plants not to be toxic to the neighbor's outdoor cats. Okay, I'm not going to get into the whole debate about cats being outdoors, but I will say cat poisonings by landscape plants are extremely rare, to the point that I've never heard of one. So if any of you out there are aware of cats foraging in the landscape and being harmed by it, send us a note, davisgardenshow@gmail.com. But it just doesn't seem like a major concern with the choice of a shrub for your yard. For your house plant, that's a different conversation. For the bouquet of flowers that you have with lilies in it, that's a significant issue in terms of danger to your cat in the house. Being concerned about the toxicity of plants and neighborhood cats seemed a little bit much. But of course, in each case, we had to look them up one by one. So that was a criteria that really narrowed down the list quite a bit, unfortunately. Main thing being, if you come in and you have a place, the thing we're going to need to know, first question we're going to ask you is it sun or shade? Is it irrigated or not? Do you plan to irrigate this area? What are you looking for? Flowers, food, or foliage? You know, is it that's the kind of practical aspects of it. But we go through this process, and landscape designers, by the way, also go through this process. That's exactly what they're doing. They're taking a schematic of your yard and choosing plants for that. We work with landscape designers all the time. They're sending us notes regularly. Does this grow here? Is this something that is obtainable? Is this a proprietary thing? Can nurseries get this? Because they don't want to put things on plans, if they're good designers, that aren't going to be easy to find. And as to the toxicity thing, well, that's a whole separate conversation. But plant selection for environmental design was literally the name of a course I took. And it's what we do on a regular basis, plant selection for particular things. Google is less and less useful as time goes by. And you know how I feel about artificial intelligence. So.
So Don says the best way to figure out what plant is going to be in your yard is to find a place and then find a plant that will be happy there. Unfortunately, I'm Lois, and what I have usually done over the years is been at the Arboretum, seen a plant, usually in the plant sale, going, oh, this is spectacular. Oh, I want this thing. Buy it. Run home. And then show up at Don's place going, where can I put this?
Oh, I do this all the time. Yes, yes.
It's not the right thing to do. have a giant place. You have much land.
I still run into this problem.
Resources.
No, I still run into this problem.
Places.
Yes. You're getting a plant first and then choosing where it goes is what plant collectors do. That's what plant hobbyists do. We're used to that. I remember many times walking up and down the long driveway perennial border back when it was sunnier and going, whoop, ran out of space. We don't have a place for this thing now. All right, time to start a new border somewhere. Yes, that's another approach is I have this plant. What is the place I should put it? Probably would have been better to do I have this place. What is the right plant for it?
Yeah,
that, you know, I'm gonna hold up a really, really good reference book on this topic.
Oh, your Western Garden
book. The Sunset Western Garden book, which sits next to the computer as we do this. And in the front of this book, Landscape Plants with Showy Flowers, A Guide to Plant Selections, Colorful Fruits and Berries, Showy Perennials for Beds and Borders, Native Plants. Flowers for cutting, plants that attract butterflies and hummingbirds. And this is the Western Garden Book. So if you look in here, you'll go, oh, zone 14. Yeah, it works there. So it would save you a lot of trouble if you just went back to the old days when we used reference books. And although this has not been published since, I think, 2012, it's still quite valid. It's just there's a lot of new plants that have come into the trade that aren't going to be in the Western Garden Book. That's where you need to ask your local nursery. But you can also do some educated guesswork. Yeah. All right. So if... we have now probably 20 varieties of agapanthus that we can get, lily of the Nile. New varieties, they bloom longer, they're darker blue, they're vivid, and a bunch of really cool varieties of agapanthus. Will they grow here? Well, I can give you from an educated guess standpoint, regular agapanthus does, the kind you bought 50 years ago, these new varieties almost certainly will. If there's an exception, we'll know about that. And if there's an exception, you'll probably be able to find some information about it. So the Western Garden Book, reference books remain, and in fact, increasingly, I'm finding myself using the Western Garden Book more than I used to. I had gotten in the same habit as everybody else of Googling stuff when I'm looking for a quick answer. And now I'm getting insanely frustrated when I do that because I have to scroll through like four pages of garbage links. They're fake sites. They're not even real. They're generated artificially, and the information in them is variable as to accuracy. So regrettably, the internet is not the resource it used to be, except for cooperative extension sites, master gardener sites, legitimate nurseries that actually have websites that they keep updated. Those are the places you'll get information off the internet. The best bet is to talk to people locally. All gardening is local.
And
all gardeners are local.
That too. But we generally have a library in our town, whatever town that is. And in the reference section, they may well have, I hope they have, Western Garden Books.
Well, I have most of those now, actually, because I know, but people keep bringing them to the library sales. I now have like 50 of them at my
house. Yeah, but the library already has it. That's why the excess is in the sale.
Hopefully we have one. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks to a listener who is also a bibliophile, we have an amazing collection of garden books at our nursery, some of which, for the record, are free. So if you go upstairs to where the terrariums and many of the houseplants are, over in the corner there, some books that are there that are our library, and some of them, there's a table that says free. A lot of the sunset books, a lot of the ortho books, the old single topic books, we're just giving them away. And people love that. These were really good. This is every gardener in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Had piles of books. You'd get a book on bonsai. You get a book on roses. Sunset did very good ones. Ortho did very good ones. HP were some of the best. The HP Citrus book is still one of the best that's out there. And you can find these now at library sales. And they're all out of print, but they're still very, very useful. And a lot of those are on a table that says books free. And people come down, they go, these are free? They're free. We want you to be an educated, successful gardener. This is a good step in the right direction.
There, we talked about some local plants, and there is another one called redbud. Now, redbud is something that isn't just here. It's all over the place. There's so many different kinds of redbud. And our friend Linus sent us a link to an article. The magazine is Botany in Bloom, and it's Dr. Dennis Werner's Living Laboratory. And Dr. Dennis Werner makes redbuds. I mean, this article shows pictures of his place and all these different kinds of things. And the redbuds are incredible. I mean, just amazing stuff.
He's been breeding and selecting redbuds, which is the genus Cercis, C-E-R-C-I-S. Interesting to note, I took 2 years of Latin in junior high school. There is no soft C in Latin. So if you were a Roman, you would pronounce that Circus. But we say Cercis. Great magazine. Walter Magazine is the name of it. Walter Magazine is about?
Yeah, Raleigh, North Carolina. It's called Walter Magazine because Sir Walter Raleigh is the Raleigh that Raleigh, North Carolina is named for. And Raleigh, North Carolina is the place which houses the North Carolina State University.
Yeah. And this gentleman's been selecting and breeding redbuds for years and years and years. These are Eastern redbuds for the most part. And Eastern red buds have different requirements than Western red bud, and there's quite a range within the genus Circis. So right now, continuing our ongoing feature of what's that tree that's blooming right now, the answer is red bud, blooming all over town. Two main ones in Davis that we've talked about before, so we'll just go over this briefly. If it looks like a shrub, it's probably Western red bud, Circis occidentalis. Occidentalis means Western. So that one is our native red bud, native to the foothills and the toe slopes of the foothills around us, and grows just fine here in the Sacramento Valley. And then the one that's more like a tree, if it has a single trunk, it's almost surely the Oklahoma red bud, which is a cultivar of the Eastern red bud that happens to be more tolerant of heat and more tolerant of drought than all the other cultivars of Eastern red bud. There are others, the Judas tree, Circis siliquastrum, which is from the Levant. I happen to have an Afghan red bud that was imported from Afghanistan many years ago, being grown in the Arboretum, and we grew some. They all look pretty much the same when they're in bloom. The color of red buds is generally a very strong magenta pink. There are, of course, there's some white ones, and there's some range of pink within it. And the main difference is the growth habit of the plant. And the two that you're seeing the most, there's your shrubby choice and your tree choice, are the ones that are adapted here in the valley. Red buds in general, Eastern red buds in general, need shelter from extreme dry heat, and that's not something you're typically going to have here. Bottom line, you want to plant a Western redbud, grow it as a shrub. You want a tree redbud, buy an Oklahoma redbud, which is a heat tolerant, drought tolerant variant of Eastern redbud that came from Oklahoma.
So for those of you who are like hearing about this sort of thing, if you go to waltermagazine.com, mm-hmm. that's the URL for the thing, and you search in there for Werner, W-E-R-N-E-R, you'll find this article about Dr. Werner and his redbuds.
Well, North Carolina has one of the best extension sites of any of the horticulture programs around the country. We find ourselves using it all the time for poisonous plant information. It's actually one of the best. North Carolina Extension Gardener Plant Toolbox at NorthCarolinaStateUniversity.edu, NCSU.edu. I think it's way more useful, honestly, than the ASPCA plant toxicity website. And the difference being, the ASPCA plant toxicity website is just binary. If a plant contains a toxin, they list it as toxic. They don't go into risk in any way. Whereas this site does give you more information about the degree of toxicity. And so it's got lots and lots of information about outside plants. Now, you know, scrolling through it, I'm seeing obviously a lot of East Coast outdoor landscape plants, but we have found ourselves using their site over and over because it's one of the best in terms of finding nuanced information about plant toxicity. This is one of the most common questions that we get frustrated by. Let's put it that way. We'll be talking about plants. We'll go through a whole list of plants. And then the next question will be, is this toxic to cats? And we're going, well, I mean, that's a relative risk evaluation that I have to suddenly try and decide what your risk tolerance is. And some people's is zero and some people can understand nuance. And so it's a little bit challenging. And the ASPCA list, which is considered the gold standard by most people for, you know, whether a plant is toxic, is going to lean very heavily on the no risk evaluation. Let's put it that way. It just says, yes, it contains the substance, or no, it doesn't contain the substance. I consider the North Carolina State University list of plants, their what they call it here, their Extension Gardener Plant Toolbox, incredibly useful. So great link. Thank you very much to the listener that sent that.
Okay. I just want to read this to you and see if I got it right.
Okay.
This is about systemic treatment of trees.
Yes.
So March used to be when people would apply a systemic insecticide to their hackberry trees to prevent the Asian woolly hackberry aphid. The active ingredient is imidacloprid. Now, people are coming in now looking for this once a year drench to their apply to their trees. However, as of the first of the year, it is no longer legal to sell these insecticides to homeowners in California, and it is also illegal for homeowners to possess or apply them.
So one correction, as of January 1st, 2025. So it has been unlawful.
I'll read that over.
That's fine. It's been unlawful for us to sell or for you to possess or apply imidacloprid products in your garden since January of last year. Some people are using up their stock that they had, and they're coming in looking for this year's supply. You won't find imidacloprid in any garden center or hardware store in California. It's unlawful for us to sell it. It's unlawful for you to apply it.
But it is legal for a pest control service or a tree service that has the appropriate licenses to apply the systemic pesticide for you. Yep. That is to say, it's the exact same product, but they can do it and homeowners can't.
Yeah, the idea was to stop people from using so much imidacloprid. This is a neonicotinoid insecticide that had become increasingly and incredibly popular because it kills aphids and certain other sucking insects. And so there are labeled products of imidacloprid for vegetables, flowers, fruit trees, ornamental trees, you name it, they're out there, which concerned me. Imidacloprid is well known to be harmful to pollinators. So it said right on the label, not to apply it to plants that are flowering. Well, in the case of the hackberry, that wasn't an issue. Hackberries are wind pollinated. They bloom very, very early. So there's very little, if any, risk to pollinators for applying it to hackberries for the Asian woolly hackberry aphid. And I have people occasionally who are applying it to oak trees because they would have scale or white flies or aphids on their oak tree or something like that. Well, again, that's a wind pollinated species, so of less concern. But why would you apply it to a rose? I mean, roses are visited by pollinators. Well, it was labeled for use on roses. So someone asked me, why is it banned for home garden use? Well, this was in response to the well-established evidence that neonicotinoid insecticides are very harmful to pollinators, and it was to get home gardeners at least to stop using it. Farmers are still using it. And as noted, pest control companies, if you really want to treat your hackberry or another tree that has a sucking insect that's causing sticky residue underneath the tree, they can come out and do it. Some of the pest control companies, these are termite companies, you know, termite ant control type companies, are not as familiar with the product. So you need to ask them, if you're calling them, to get a price on this, if they actually apply this systemic. In Davis, we know that one local one does that. So if you call them, they'll know what you're talking about. You want the systemic to be that's being used on the shade tree to prevent the sticky drip from the aphids on the shade tree. They're not going to spray the tree. They're going to do the same thing you were doing, which is pour the drench on the ground. It has greatly reduced the use in cases where I thought it was actually quite inappropriate. I don't think it's great to be applying systemics to roses. Roses are visited by bees and other highly beneficial pollinators, and it was very harmful to them. So the idea was to get people away from that. Is there an alternative systemic? No. There's an alternative method of application. And so you can pay a pest control company to come out and treat the tree that's causing sticky drip all over your yard. You cannot do that yourself in the state of California. If you go online, you'll find these products. It looks like you can buy them. I think on the thing I sent you, it showed an example of one that was from, I think this was Home Depot. And right there on the pickup side, it says unavailable in California. So these are products that you can buy in other states. And this is the common joke. It's like, oh, maybe I should just drive to Nevada. Yes, you can buy it in Nevada. You can buy it in other states. So the California Department of Food and Agriculture and the legislature passed a bill specifically banning it. And the CDFA is regulating it. And if they came into my nursery and it was on the shelf, I'd be in big trouble. So you cannot buy this at local nurseries. You cannot buy it at the local hardware store. And even though you see it online, they won't ship to California. You got to do some alternative, either rinsing off the plants or whatever is that you find manageable for aphids on your roses and things like that. We can certainly talk about alternative approaches and alternative strategies for that. Biggest one being encourage beneficials in your garden, which regrettably the systemics were, you know, having the opposite impact. Or in the case of a serious nuisance tree, you can pay someone to come in and treat the tree. Should significantly reduce the home garden usage of these products, and it's still available for those who find their backyard unlivable because of the sticky residue from aphids.
The Tale of Genji, which was written in, looks like 973 or 978, it is true, as they say, that the blossoms of spring are all the more precious because they bloom so briefly.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.